R2 didn't squeal or screech as Luke swung the starfighter around in a 180-degree skid in a classic smuggler's reverse. Probably, Luke decided, as he fed power to the thrusters, because the little droid was too busy holding on for dear life. For a handful of seconds, the X-Wing bucked beneath him, and he fought hard for stability as it tried to flip out of control. Outside, the canyon walls shooting past began to slow, and as they did so, he eased off on the drive and keyed in the repulsor lifts. The deceleration pressure crushing him against the seat cushions faded. Spinning the X-Wing around to face forward again, he threw a quick look around. Directly ahead, a pair of squat but bushy trees rose up from the canyon floor, straddling what appeared to be a dry creek bed, their trunks just the right distance apart. Killing the last of the X-Wing's forward velocity, he dropped its nose down to slide neatly between the tree trunks. "There," he said, running the last steps of the landing cycle and shutting down the repulsor lifts. "That wasn't so hard now, was it?" There was a weak and slightly shaky whistle from behind him. Apparently, R2 hadn't found his voice yet. Smiling tightly, Luke popped the canopy, wincing at the high-pitched scratching sounds as dozens of thorn-edged leaves scraped across the transparasteel and slid off his helmet and gloves. The air flooding in from outside was cool and smelled vaguely mossy. For a long minute, he listened, stretching out with force-enhanced senses for sounds of pursuit. But there was nothing except the normal sounds of wind rustling through the leaves and the distant chirps of avians or insects. "I think we've lost them," he told R2. "At least for now. You figured out where we are?" R2 beeped, still sounding a little dazed, and a map appeared on the computer display. Luke studied it. Not too bad, not too good either. They were no more than 10 kilometers from Mara's cave. But most of the territory between here and there consisted of the same kind of narrow gorges and rocky cliffs they'd just been flying through. At least a full day's travel. Probably two, possibly three. On the other hand, the very roughness of the ground would give them better cover than they could reasonably have asked for. All in all, a pretty fair trade. But it wouldn't be much of a trade if the aliens found them before they even got started. "Come on," he said, easing out of the cockpit and rolling out to the ground. The attempt to avoid the leaf thorns was only partially successful, but only a couple of them actually drew blood. "Let's get the pack sorted out and get out of here." It was the work of a few minutes to break out the camo net Card had sent along and to pull it snugly over the X-Wing. Then, as an extra precaution, he cut up some of the smaller bushes and tree limbs with his lightsaber and scattered them on top of the net. It wasn't perfect, especially at close range, but it was the best he could do in the available time. Card's people had also put his survival pack together, assembling the supplies and loading them aboard the X-Wing, while Luke hurried through the data work necessary for getting off Sajansich. And as Luke had come to expect from the smugglers' organization over the years, they'd done a first-rate job of it. Split into two separate carry packs, the supplies included ration bars, water filter bottles, med packs, glow rods, a good supply of synth rope, a spare blaster, a survival tent with bedroll, and even a small selection of low-yield grenades. "I'm surprised they didn't try to cram a land speeder in," Luke grunted, as he hoisted one of the packs experimentally onto his shoulders. It was heavy enough, but the weight had been well distributed and would be reasonably easy to carry. "I guess we'll have to leave the other pack here. You ready to do a little climbing?" R2 warbled questioningly, his dome swiveling to peer first one direction down the canyon and then the other. "No, that's where they'll expect us to come out," Luke told him. He pointed upward, toward one of the cliffs towering over them. "That's our route, up there." The droid swiveled his dome again, whistling skittishly as he leaned way back to look up. "Relax. We won't have to go all the way to the top," Luke calmed him. "See that gap about two-thirds of the way up? If I read the aerial pictures right, That should lead into a cut that'll take us the rest of the way to the top. R2 warbled forlornly, looking back and forth along the canyon again. No, R2, we can't go that way, Luke told him firmly. And we don't have time to argue the point. Even if those ships can't get in there, they may have smaller ones back at the fortress. And they can always come in on foot, too. You want to be sitting around when they get here?
The droid beeped emphatically.
Swiveling himself around, he started bumping determinedly along the dry creek bed toward the base of the cliff below the gap Luke had pointed out. Smiling, Luke gave his pack one final settling shrug, and stretching out with the force, he lifted R2 high enough off the ground to clear the undergrowth and headed toward the cliff. As it turned out, the climb had looked more daunting than it really was. Though certainly steep enough, the wall wasn't nearly the impossibly vertical slope that it had seemed from the canyon floor. Hand and footholds were plentiful. The whole cliff face seemed to be dotted with narrow ledges and small caves, and the bushes and vines provided sturdy handholds as well. The only problematic part was R2, but even that quickly settled into a more or less comfortable routine. Finding a secure place to stand, Luke would use the force to lift the droid up past him to a narrow ledge or conveniently spaced pair of caves, hold him in place while using the synth rope to lash him to the nearest bushes, then climb past him to the next convenient resting point, and repeat. R2 didn't care for any part of the procedure, of course. Midway up the cliff, though, he at least stopped complaining about it. They were almost to the gap, and Luke was once again catching up to the point where he'd anchored R2 when he heard the faint voice. He stopped, one hand gripping a lumpy vine, and listened. But there was nothing but the distant insect chirping he'd been hearing since they landed. Running through his Jedi sensory enhancement techniques, he stretched out his hearing. But though the chirps became louder and more varied, the voice he'd thought he'd heard wasn't there. There was a loud squeal from above him, R2 whistling softly in his enhanced hearing.
I thought I heard something,
he murmured back, the words booming in his head. Hastily, he eased his hearing back to normal.
It was like a voice.
He broke off at R2's startled twitter.
What is it?
He asked, looking up. The droid was facing down and along the cliff, turning his head. Luke tracked along his gaze and froze. Perched on a thorn-leafed bush, not 3 meters away, was a small, slack-winged, brown-gray creature. Watching him.
Take it easy,
Luke soothed R2, taking a moment to study the creature. About 30 centimeters long from head to talons, it was covered with smooth-looking skin. Its folded wings were more of the same, though it was hard to guess their size, and arched slightly over in a way that reminded Luke of hunched shoulders. The head was proportionally small and streamlined, with a pair of dark eyes nestled beneath fleshy folds and 2 horizontal slashes beneath them. The upper slash was undulating with the steady rhythm of respiration, while the lower was pressed into a tight slit. A pair of segmented, wide-taloned feet gripped the bush it was perched on, apparently not bothered in the least by the sharp thorns. The overall effect was like something halfway between a Minock and a praying Macfear, and he wondered if it was related to either of those species. R2 gave another warble, this one wary.
I don't think it means us any harm,
Luke assured him, still watching the creature.
I don't sense any danger from it. And we're a little big for a snack for something that size.
Unless, of course, they hunted in packs. Still watching the creature, he stretched out with the force, searching for others of the species. There were definitely more of them in the canyon, but most seemed to be fairly distant. The lower slit on the creature's face opened, revealing 2 rows of tiny, sharp teeth, and emitted a loud chirp.
Who are you?
Luke blinked in surprise, there was the voice he thought he'd heard. Except that this time it was clear enough to understand. But had it come from...
What?
He asked. The creature chirped again.
Who are you?
He was right. It was the creature who'd spoken. Only it hadn't spoken. Not really. But then, how had Luke understood? And then, abruptly, he understood.
I'm Luke Skywalker,
he said, stretching toward the creature with the Force.
Jedi Knight of the New Republic. Who are you?
The creature emitted a short series of chirps.
What do you do here, Jedi Knight Skywalker?
I'm looking for a friend,
Luke said. His guess had been right. While he couldn't understand the creature's actual chirping language, he was pulling the essence of the communication from its mind via the Force. An extremely rare event in his experience, and it probably implied the creatures were at least marginally Force-sensitive.
She landed near here nearly 2 weeks ago, and then disappeared. Do you know where she is?
The creature seemed to shy back a bit. It fluffed its wings, partially open, resettled them across its back. It chirped again.
Who is this friend?
Her name is Mara Jade,
Luke said.
Is she another Jedi Knight?
Sort of, Luke hedged. Mara had dropped by his Jedi Academy occasionally over the past 8 years, but she'd never stayed long enough to complete her training. Actually, there were times Luke wondered if she'd ever truly begun it.
Do you know where she is?
The wings fluffed again as the creature chirped.
I know nothing.
Really?
Luke said, letting his tone cool just a bit. He didn't even need the Force for this one. He'd watched Jason, Jaina, and Anakin pull this trick enough times to recognize guilty knowledge when he saw it.
What if I told you a Jedi can always tell when someone's lying?
From behind him came a loud and authoritative chirp.
Leave the young one alone!
Luke turned his head. Perched on the bushes and craggy rocks on the other side of the cliff face were three more of the creatures. They were each twice as big as the first one, but even without the size differential, the subtle differences between adult and young were instantly apparent.
Your pardon, he said to them. I wasn't trying to intimidate him. Perhaps you can help me in my search for my friend.
One of the creatures spread his wings and gave a short hop to a bush closer to Luke, twisting his head one way and then the other, as if studying the intruder out of each eye individually.
You are not one of the others. Who are you?
I think you know,
Luke said, a quiet sense prompting him to play a hunch.
Why don't you tell me instead who you are?
The creature seemed to consider.
I am Hunter of Winds. I bargain for this nesting of the Quamquay.
In the name of the New Republic, I greet you, Hunter of Winds,
Luke said gravely.
I presume you know of the New Republic?
The elder Quamquay fluffed his wings exactly the same way the young one had.
I have heard. What is the New Republic to us?
I suppose that depends on what you want it to be,
Luke said.
But that's a matter for diplomats and bargainers to discuss. I'm here to help a friend.
Hunter of Winds chirped decisively.
We have no knowledge of any strangers.
But we do,
the younger Quamquay chirped from behind Luke.
The Quamja spoke of...
Hunter of Winds cut him off with a squawk.
Is your name Seeker After Stupidity?
He demanded pointedly.
Be silent!
Perhaps you have merely forgotten, Luke suggested diplomatically. A nesting bargainer must have many other matters to think about, after all.
Hunter of Winds fluffed his wings.
What happens outside this nesting does not properly concern us. Go to another nesting of the Quam Que, or to the Quam Ja, if you dare. Perhaps they will help you.
All right, Luke said. Will you guide me to them?
They are outside this nesting,
Hunter of Winds chirped.
They are not our concern.
I see, Luke said. Tell me, Hunter of Winds, have you ever had a friend in danger?
The Quam Que spread his wings, his two companions following suit.
This conversation is ended, young one. Come!
He leaped out from his bush, gliding away toward the canyon floor below on outstretched wings, his two companions following. Turning back, Luke saw the young Quam Que follow them. R2 grunted contemptuously.
Don't blame them too much, Luke told him with a sigh. There may be cultural or political entanglements here we don't know about.
He resumed his climb.
Or they may just be wary of getting involved in someone else's fight, he added. We've certainly seen enough of that over the years.
5 minutes later, they'd reached the gap. Luke had been right. The cut continued upward toward the top of the cliff at a much more leisurely angle, while still keeping them under tree cover the whole way.
Perfect,
Luke said, peering up along it.
Let's get up to the top and see where we can go from here.
Collecting the synth rope, he started to coil it, and suddenly R2 emitted a startled squawk.
What is it?
Luke demanded, grabbing reflexively for his lightsaber as he spun around. There was no danger around them that he could see or sense.
R2, what is it?
He asked again, turning his attention to the droid. R2 was gazing back down into the valley along the way they'd come, moaning mournfully. Frowning, Luke followed along the droid's line of sight and felt his breath catch in his throat. Down on the valley floor, their X-wing had vanished.
No,
Luke breathed. Gazing hard at the browns and grays down there, his first hopeful thought was that his camouflage job had simply been better than he realized, and that the starfighter was still right where they'd left it. But a moment of careful searching with Jedi-enhanced senses put that hope quietly to rest. The X-Wing was indeed gone. R2 warbled anxiously.
It's all right, Luke soothed.
It's all right. And to his own mild surprise, he found he actually meant it. The X-Wing's disappearing act was frustrating and annoying, but oddly enough, there was no sense of danger or fear accompanying it. Not even any serious concern, despite the fact that the loss of their ship meant no chance for a quick escape should the situation warrant it. A prodding from the Force? A sense, perhaps, that the X-Wing was merely misplaced and not actually lost? Unfortunately, he realized soberly, it could just as easily be a prodding in the opposite direction. That the loss of the ship didn't matter, because he would not be leaving this world alive anyway. Unbidden, as an image of Yoda rose from his memory, the old Jedi Master sighing with weariness as he settled onto his bed for the last time. Luke could remember his gut-churning fear at Yoda's frailness, could recall the exact tone of his voice as he protested to Yoda that he must not die.
Strong am I with the Force,
Yoda had gently reproved his student.
But not that strong. Twilight is upon me, and soon night will fall. That is the way of things, the way of the Force.
Luke took a deep breath. Obi-Wan had died. Yoda had died. And someday, it would be his turn to face that same journey. And if this was the place where that journey would begin, so be it. He was a Jedi, and would face it as one. In the meantime, the reason he had come here had not changed.
"Nothing we can do about it now,"
he told R2, turning away from the valley and returning to the task of coiling the synth rope.
"Let's get to the top and see where we go from there."
From directly above came a soft chirp.
"There are better ways to pass."
Luke looked up. The young Quam Quay was back, hovering on some updraft he'd found and gazing down at them.
"Are you offering to help us?"
he asked. The Quam Quay bent one of his wings slightly, the change in air pressure sending him sidling over to the cliff face beside Luke. He caught one of the bushes in his talons as he reached it, folding his wings behind him.
"I will help you. The Quamja have said another has arrived and is with them. I will take you there."
"Thank you,"
Luke said, wondering if he should ask about his missing X-Wing. But after the young Quam Quay's skittishness earlier, it probably would be better to leave any interrogations for later.
"May I ask why you're willing to take the risk?"
"I am known to some of the younger Quamja. I do not fear them."
"I'm not necessarily talking about the Quamja,"
Luke said, wanting to make sure the young alien genuinely understood the risks.
"The others Hunter of Wind spoke of may also try to stop us."
"I understand that,"
the alien fluffed his wings.
"But you asked Hunter of Winds if he had ever had a friend in danger. I have."
Luke smiled. "I understand," he said. "And I'm honored to have your assistance. I'm Luke Skywalker, as I said, and this is my droid, R2. What's your name?"
The Quam Quay spread his wings and made a short hop to a bush in front of them.
"I am too young yet to have a name. I am called merely Child of Winds."
"Child of Winds,"
Luke repeated, eyeing him thoughtfully.
"You wouldn't by any chance be related to Hunter of Winds, would you?"
"He is my sire,"
Child of Winds chirped.
"It is indeed true, but the wisdom of the Jedi Knights."
Luke suppressed a smile.
"Sometimes," he said. "But we should get moving now. Along the way, perhaps you can tell me more about your people."
"I would be honored,"
Child of Wind said, spreading his wings eagerly.
"Come, I will show you the path."
Chapter 3.
The communications blister on the New Republic dreadnought Peregrine was something of an anachronism among modern warships, a throwback to the pre-Clone Wars design philosophy that had prevailed at the time the Peregrine and its Katana fleet sister ships had been built. Not only was the ship's entire primary antenna array located in the blister, but so were the complex and delicate encryption-decryption computers. The handful of other Katana fleet dreadnoughts still in New Republic service had had their comm blisters extensively renovated, with the encrypt-decrypt equipment moved inside into a more sheltered area between the bridge and intelligence ops. But somehow, no matter how often the renovation procedure was talked about, the Peregrine always seemed to slip through the cracks in the work schedule. Wedge Antilles had wondered about that on occasion. There was, he knew, still some bad blood between General Garm Bel Iblis and a few of the New Republic's upper echelon, dating back to Bel Iblis's years of running his own private war against the Empire after his falling out with Mon Mothma. Wedge had always suspected the lack of renovation on this, The General's flagship was tied to that animosity. It wasn't until Wedge and Rogue Squadron had been permanently assigned to Bel Iblis that he'd learned the truth. Intelligence sections, Bel Iblis had explained to him, were crowded in public places, and having a decrypted signal piped to bridge or command room gave abundant opportunity for anyone with a modicum of skill and a surplus of curiosity to tap into the conversation. A comm blister, in contrast, was about as isolated a place as one could find aboard a warship, and having the encrypt-decrypt computer close at hand meant that the message began and ended right there. Whenever any really private transmissions were due, that was where Bel Iblis was to be found. He and Wedge were there now, at Admiral Akbar's personal request.
"I understand your concerns, General Bel Iblis," Akbar said, his face filling the comm display, his huge eyes swiveling around to take in Wedge as well. "And I do not disagree with your assessment, but I must nevertheless turn down your request."
"I strongly urge you to reconsider, Admiral," Bel Iblis said stiffly. "I appreciate the political situation on Coruscant, but that can't be allowed to blind us to the purely military considerations here."
The Mon Cal's lip tendrils seemed to stiffen.
"Unfortunately, there are no longer any pure military considerations involving the Kar-Mas issue. Political and ethical questions have pervaded everything."
"Unusual combination," Wedge murmured under his breath.
One of Akbar's eyes swiveled briefly toward him, before turning back to Bel Iblis.
"The final line of the situation is that any serious New Republic presence over Bothawi at this point would be construed as support of the Bothans against their critics."
"It would be nothing of the sort," Bel Iblis objected. "It would be a voice of calm and reason in the middle of a very dangerous flashpoint. There are 68 warships here already, all of them engaged in a 12-way glaring contest with each other, all of them ready to jump if any of the others so much as sneeze. There has got to be someone here who can mediate any problems before they collapse into an all-out war."
Akbar sighed, a darkly rasping sound.
"I agree with you wholeheartedly, General. But the High Council and Senate are an ultimate authority here, and they have come to a different conclusion."
Bel Iblis threw a baleful glance at Wedge.
"I trust you'll continue trying to change their minds."
"Yes, indeed. But whether I am successful or not, you will not be the one chosen for the dubious honor of mediator. President Gavrasim has already selected another task for you."
"More important than keeping the peace over Bothawi?"
"Far more important. If Bothawi is the flashpoint, then it is the Kar-Mas document which is the spark."
Wedge felt a sudden premonition hit him. Could Gavrasim actually be considering? He was.
"President Gavrasim has therefore concluded that the New Republic's best chance of defusing the controversy is to obtain an intact copy of the document. To that end, you are to proceed immediately to Ord Trassi, where you will begin assembling a force for an information raid on the Imperial Ubiquitary base at Yaga Minor."
Wedge stole a furtive glance at Bel Iblis. The General's expression hadn't changed, but there was just enough of a tightness in his jaw to show he was thinking along the same lines Wedge was.
"With all due respect, Admiral," Bel Iblis said, "President Gavrasim must be joking. Yaga Minor is possibly the most heavily defended system in Imperial or New Republic space, and that's just considering a straight-line attack, where it doesn't matter which enemy positions come under fire. Having to keep the enemy data system intact adds 5 extra layers of difficulty to the whole operation."
"The President is well aware of the challenges involved,"
Akbar said, his voice even more gravelly than usual.
"I'll be honest. I don't like this any more than you do. But it has to be tried. If war breaks out over this issue, we don't have enough ships or troops to either force or maintain the peace. The entire New Republic could conceivably collapse into total civil war.
Bill Iblis looked at Wedge again, turned back to the display.
Yes, sir,
he said.
Unfortunately, I'm forced to agree with your assessment.
I may also say that if there's any way this can be done, you are the one who can do it.
Bill Iblis smiled wryly.
Thank you for your confidence, Admiral. I'll do my best.
Good. You and your task force are to leave Bothaway immediately for Ord Tassi. I'll be quietly sending you the rest of your ships over the next 2 weeks, at which time I expect you to have a battle plan formulated and ready to go.
Understood,
Bill Iblis said.
What about special equipment or units?
Anything the New Republic can supply is yours. Tell me what you need, and I'll have it sent to you.
Bill Iblis nodded.
We will, of course, need total secrecy on this,
he warned.
If even a hint leaks to the Empire, what little chance we have will be gone.
The secrecy will be complete,
Akbar promised.
I've already set a cover story in motion which should convince any Imperial spies that the ships are secretly being assembled in the outer regions of the Kothless system for the defense of Bothawee, should that become necessary.
That should work,
Bill Iblis said.
Provided they don't head to Kothless and take a look for themselves.
Two Rendili space docks have already been moved to the Kothless system. They'll be equipped with dummy ships carrying the proper IDs and markings for the benefit of any Imperials who happen by.
Interesting.
Bill Iblis cocked an eyebrow.
So this isn't just some slice-of-the-moment idea Gaverson came up with last night. This has been in the works for some time now.
The Mon Cal nodded his massive head.
The preparations were begun the day after the riot at the Combined Clans building on Bothawee. With General Solo's implication in that incident, the President knew it would no longer be possible for the New Republic government to make any overt political moves without our motives coming under fire.
I understand the reasoning involved,
Billy Bliss said heavily.
Ord Tressy it is, then.
A liaison team from my office will be waiting there when you arrive. Good luck, General.
Thank you, Admiral. Bill Iblis out.
The General touched a key, and the transmission ended.
Which doesn't mean I entirely agree with it,
he commented under his breath to the blank display as he turned to Wedge.
Well, General, comments?
Wedge shook his head.
I was on an information raid once, back when we were trying to get data on Grand Admiral Makati out at the Boudelais Library,
he said.
I think the bit pushers estimated afterward that we were about 80% successful. And that was Boudelais, not Yaga Minor.
Yes, I've read the reports on that raid,
Bill Iblis said, stroking his mustache thoughtfully.
This is definitely not gonna be easy.
Wedge grimaced.
Meanwhile, Bothawee keeps collecting warships like a floodlight collects night insects. Eventually, sir, someone's going to try to take advantage of that.
I agree,
Bill Iblis said.
Which is why I asked you to come up here with me this afternoon.
Oh?
Wedge said, regarding him closely.
Then you knew this was coming?
Not the Yaga Minor raid specifically,
Bill Iblis said.
But I had a feeling Coruscant would turn down my request to stay here and keep order. It also occurred to me that if my task force was ordered away, as we now indeed have been, the Rogue Squadron isn't technically part of that task force.
Wedge frowned.
You've lost me, General. I thought we'd been permanently attached to you.
To me, yes, Bill Iblis agreed. But not to my task force. It's a fine but very important technical distinction.
I'll take your word for it, Wedge said, trying without success to sift confirmation of that point from his own memory of the New Republic military regs.
So, what does that mean?
Bel Iblis swiveled the encrypt station chair around and sat down.
It means I agree with you that someone is likely to take advantage of this mess, he said, folding his hands in his lap. Possibly the shadowy vengeance organization that keeps throwing riots and demanding the Bothans pay through the snout for their part in the destruction of Ka-Mas.
Yes, Wedge said slowly, as a sudden thought hit him. And since the Bothan contribution to that attack was to sabotage the Ka-Mas planetary shields...
Bel Iblis nodded.
Very good. Yes. My guess is someone's going to try to take out Bothawee's shields.
Wedge whistled softly.
Do you think that's even possible? The Bothans are supposed to have one of the best shield systems in the galaxy.
They did once, back at the height of the Empire,
Bel Iblis said.
Whether they've kept it up, I don't know. But of course, an enemy wouldn't have to take down the entire grid to do serious damage. Dropping the shield just over Drev's Tarn would open up a hole you could pour a lot of turbo laser damage through.
Yes, Wedge murmured. Trouble is, it wouldn't be just the Bothans who'd get hammered.
That is indeed the problem,
Bel Iblis agreed soberly.
At last count, there were over 300 megacorporations with their headquarters on Bothawee, plus thousands of smaller companies and at least 50 pledge and commodity exchanges.
Wedge nodded. It wouldn't exactly mean universal economic chaos if they were hit, but it would add a considerable degree of extra anger and resentment to the stew already heating up out there. And with all those warships trying to stare each other down overhead, it might do considerably more than just heat the stew.
What do you want me to do?
Bel Iblis seemed to be studying his face.
I want you to go down to the surface and make sure that doesn't happen.
Wedge had had a sneaking suspicion that was the direction this conversation was going. It came as something of a shock, just the same.
All by myself? He asked. Or do you think I might need the rest of Rogue Squadron, too?
Bel Iblis smiled.
Relax, Wedge. It's not as bad as it sounds, he said. I'm not expecting you to stand in front of the Drevstarn generator dome, a blaster in each hand, and hold off the third Imperial heavy armor. So far, Vengeance has shown more trickery and subterfuge than brute force. And trickery and subterfuge are things a couple of clever X-Wing pilots ought to have a good chance of spotting.
So the proposed scout party was up to two now, Wedge noted, thereby doubling their chances of rooting out this theoretical splinter in a sandhill.
Did you have anyone in particular in mind as the second clever X-Wing pilot?
Of course, Bel Iblis said. Commander Horn.
I see,
Wedge said between suddenly stiff lips. A search for a hidden saboteur, and Bel Iblis had immediately come up with Corran Horn. Could he somehow have deduced Corran's carefully hidden Jedi skills?
Why him?
Bel Iblis's eyebrows lifted slightly.
Because his father-in-law is a smuggler, he said. He's bound to have a network of contacts Horn will be able to access.
Ah,
Wedge said, relaxing a bit.
I hadn't thought about that.
That's why I'm a senior general, Bel Iblis said dryly. You better get below and give Horn the good news. You heard Akbar. I only have a couple of weeks to pull all this together, and I want you back with the squadron when we hit Yagga Minor.
We'll do what we can, Wedge promised. You want us to take one of the Peregrine's unmarked shuttles?
Bel Iblis nodded.
X-Wings would be a little conspicuous. Leave your uniforms, too. But take your military IDs in case you have to pull rank on some bureaucrat. I'll let you know when I want you at Ord Trassi.
Understood, Wedge said.
Good.
Bell Iblis said.
I'm gonna stay up here for a few minutes. I can transmit to the other commanders from here as well as I can from the bridge or my office. Akbar said immediately, though. So as soon as the other ships are ready to go, you'll need to be off the Peregrine before that.
We will, sir,
Wedge said, moving toward the door.
Good luck with your battle plan, General.
Bell Iblis smiled faintly.
Good luck with yours.
They were just hitting Bothawi's atmosphere when Corin, who'd been leaning against the side viewport looking back toward the shuttle's stern, turned around and settled himself back into his seat.
They're gone, he announced.
Wedge glanced at his displays. The ships of the Peregrine Task Force were indeed no longer registering.
That they are, he agreed. We're on our own now.
Corin shook his head.
This is crazy, Wedge. And you say he specifically told you to take me? Yes, but it didn't have anything to do with your hidden talents, Wedge assured him. He thinks you'll be able to access Booster Smuggling Network.
Corin snorted.
That might work, if Booster was speaking to me these days.
Wedge glanced sideways at him.
What? He's not still mad about that trick we pulled with the Hoopster's prank off Sifkrik, is he? I thought we decided they weren't carrying any contraband and let them go.
No, they weren't. And yes, he is,
Corin said.
Clean or not, the Sifkris decided they didn't want smugglers carrying cargoes for them, and banned the Hoopster's prank forthwith from future Palmworm shipments.
Wedge winced. Ouch.
Doesn't mean they won't get in anyway,
Corin continued with a shrug.
It just means they'll have to come up with different ships or new ID camouflage or something. But it's a nuisance, and Booster hates nuisances. Especially official nuisances.
Wedge said.
Sorry about that. Maybe Mirax will be able to calm him down.
Oh, I'm sure she will,
Corin said.
Come to think of it, though, I'm not sure Booster even has any interests on Bothawi. The planet's got so many other smuggling groups crawling all over it, he may have decided to leave it alone.
Oh, that's handy,
Wedge grumbled.
Hey, you're the one who wanted to get back to the exciting life of an X-Wing pilot, remember?
Corin reminded him.
You could have been safely flying a computer somewhere on Coruscant if you wanted.
Wedge made a face.
No thanks. Tried it, didn't like it. So you're not expecting us to find any help down there at all?
There was a brief silence.
That's an interesting question,
Corin murmured at last, his voice sounding odd.
Actually, I think I am.
Wedge threw him a frown.
You are what? Expecting to find help?
I think so. Yes,
Corin said, that same strange tone in his voice.
Don't ask how or where. I think so.
Let me guess,
Wedge said.
Jedi hunch?
Corin nodded.
Jedi hunch.
Wedge smiled.
Good,
he said, already feeling better about this whole mission.
In that case, we don't have anything to worry about.
Well, no,
Corin said slowly.
I don't think I'd go so far as to say that.
Chapter 4
Ta! Svarta! Beware! To the starboard!
The Tagorian female at the wild card sensor station called, her normally fluid, mewling speech now clipped and harsh.
At the 255-14 angle!
I'm on it!
Another tight voice came over the bridge comm unit. The edges of 100 asteroids rolling sedately past the viewport flickered with reflected light as one of the wild card's turbolasers flashed, then blazed even more brightly as the target asteroid shattered into dust and fire. Seated in the back of the bridge, out of the way, Shada Dukal mentally shook her head. Negotiating an asteroid field was never an easy task, but it seemed to her that Tagorian and at least one of the turbolaser gunners were getting themselves far too worked up over the whole operation. Either they were naturally excitable, or else young and inexperienced. Neither possibility exactly filled her with confidence. Both made her wonder about their captain's wisdom in bringing the two of them along in the first place. Perhaps the captain was feeling the same way.
Calm down, Hasishi.
Talon Card cautioned the Tagorian from his seat behind the helm and co-pilot stations.
You too, Charl. Just because this asteroid field is larger than others you've encountered, doesn't mean it has to be treated any differently. A light touch, blast only the rocks that are in immediate danger to us, and let Dankin maneuver the ship around the others.
The Tagorian's ears twitched.
I obey, chieftain,
she said.
Yes, sir,
the gunner's voice added. Not that the admonition made any appreciable difference. At least not that Shada could see. Hasishi still continued to snap out her targeting locks, and Chal still fired full-power turbolaser blasts, whether the target warranted that much of a kick or not. But then, maybe it wasn't just them. Maybe they were merely sensing and reacting to the nervousness Card himself was feeling. Shada shifted her gaze to focus on his profile. He was hiding it well, actually, with only cheek and jaw muscles betraying the tension there. But Mistral training included the reading of faces and body language, and to her eyes, Card's steadily growing apprehension was as obvious as a navigational beacon. And the upcoming stopover at Pembroke 2 was only the first leg of their trip. What would he be like, she wondered uneasily, by the time they actually reached Exocron? There was a particularly bright flash outside, as a particularly large asteroid was blown to dust.
Oh my!
A gloomy metallic voice murmured from Shada's right. She turned to look at the C-3PO protocol droid strapped into the seat next to her. He was staring at the viewport, wincing with every turbolaser blast.
Trouble?
She asked.
I'm sorry, Mistress Shada,
he said, managing to sound prim and miserable at the same time.
I've never entirely enjoyed space travel, and this in particular reminds me of a rather unpleasant incident in the past.
It should be over soon,
she soothed him.
Just try to relax.
The Mistral Shadow Guard had never used droids all that much, but one of Shada's uncles had had one when she was growing up, and she'd always had something of a soft spot for them. And in 3PO's case, she felt a particularly personal sympathy for his position. Leia Organa Solo's personal translator droid, he had been suddenly and summarily offered to Card for this voyage. No notice, no questions, no apologies. In many ways, it echoed Shada's own long and unquestioning service to the Mistral. A service that had come to a sudden and permanent end a month ago, on the windswept roof of the Resonim Entertainment Complex, where Shada had dared to put her personal honor above direct orders from the Eleven, the rulers of her shattered world of Emberline. Would the rest of the Mistral be hunting her now? Her old friend Karoli Dulin had hinted that would be the case. But with the New Republic simmering towards self-destruction in a flurry of petty wars and revived grudges, surely the Mistral had more important things to do than hunt down even a perceived traitor. On the other hand, if Karoli had reported Shada's reasons for her defiance, had repeated the words of scorn for leaders who had now forgotten the proud and honorable tradition the Mistral had once held to, then the Eleven might indeed consider her worth the effort to track down. Of all motivations to action, she had long since learned that injured pride was one of the most powerful, and one of the most destructive as well, to both the victim and the hunter. Emotion caught her eye, Card half turning in his seat to look at her.
Enjoying the ride?
He asked.
Oh, it's great fun,
she told him.
Nothing I like better than doing tight maneuvers with a cold crew.
The Tagorian's fur expanded just a little, but she didn't comment, and she kept her eyes on her displays.
new experiences are what give zest to life, Card said mildly.
In my line of work, new experiences usually mean trouble,
Sheeta countered.
I hope you weren't planning on sneaking in, by the way. The way your people are lighting up the field, all of Pembroke 2 knows we're coming by now.
As if to underline her words, the asteroids outside flickered with a multiple sputter of turbolaser fire.
Actually, according to Mara, most ships have to do some blasting on the way in,
Card said. His fingers, Sheeta noted, were tapping gently but restlessly on his armrest.
Even the locals, who supposedly know the routes in and out.
We have cleared the asteroid field, Chieftain Card,
the Tagorian mewled. Sheeta looked back at the viewport. There were still some asteroids floating past, but for the most part, the sky was indeed clear.
The planetary landing beacons are in sight,
Asishi added, turning her head and fixing her yellow eyes on Sheeta.
Your junior crew drone may now cease her nervousness.
Sheeta held that gaze for another 2 heartbeats. Then, deliberately, she turned away. Most of the Wild Card's crew had been verbally poking at her in one way or another ever since their departure from Coruscant. Mazik's people had done the same back when she first joined his smuggling group. The usual reaction, she had long ago realized, of a tight-knit crew who have just had a stranger thrust into their midst. One of Mazik's techs had unwisely crossed the line from verbal to physical jabs, and as a result had spent a month in a neural reconstruction facility. Out here, at the edge of civilization, she hoped the Wild Card's crew wouldn't have to learn the lesson the same way. The pilot half turned around.
What now, Chief?
Take us into orbit, Card told him. There's only one place on the planet that can handle a ship this size. The air with that spaceport. They should be calling with landing instructions any time now.
Right on cue, the comm crackled.
Pristam Shun,
a sharp voice snapped.
Sikoha! Her Earthwatch, Rosput Bonsunk, Rosput Hok Tums Hoks of Porfur.
Sheeta frowned.
I thought you said they spoke basic here,
she said.
They do, Card said. They must be trying to throw us.
He cocked an eyebrow at the droid beside Sheeta.
3PO, do you recognize it?
Oh, yes, Captain Card,
the droid said, with the first sign of enthusiasm Sheeta had seen in him since the trip started.
I am fluent in over 6 million forms of communication. This is the dominant Jarellian dialect, a language whose antecedents date back to...
What did he say?
Sheeta interrupted gently. Protocol droids, in her limited experience, would go running on side trails all day if you let them. And Card didn't look like he was in the mood for a linguistics lesson. 3PO turned around to face her.
He has identified himself as Erwithat Space Control, Mr. Sheeta, and asked our identity and cargo.
Tell him we're the freighter Hab Camber, Card said. We're here to buy some supplies and power.
3PO turned back to him, his posture indicating uncertainty.
But, sir, this ship is named the Wild Card. Its engine transponder code is...
has been carefully altered.
The pilot interrupted sharply.
Come on, they're waiting. Patience, Duncan, Card said. We're in no particular hurry, and I doubt Air Without Control has anything better to do right now. Just deliver the message as stated, 3PO. No, wait.
He interrupted himself, a sly smile twitching at the corners of his mouth.
You said this was the dominant Jarellian dialect. Are there any others?
Several, sir. Unfortunately, I am versed in only 2.
Good enough, Card said. Deliver our answer in one of them.
He settled himself back in his chair.
Let's see how far they're prepared to go with this game.
3PO delivered the message, and for a long moment, the comm was silent.
Attention, unidentified freighter,
a voice growled reluctantly in Basic.
This is Air Without Space Control. State your identity and cargo.
Card smiled.
Apparently not very far, he commented, keying his transmit key. Air Without Control, this is the freighter Hab Camber, he said. No cargo, we're just passing through, and hoped we could buy some supplies and power.
Yeah, what sort of supplies?
Do you handle merchandising duties as well as space control?
No, I just do the traffic.
The other growled, sounding more annoyed than ever.
Let's hear your bid for landing rights.
Shada blinked.
Landing rights?
She muttered. The controller had sharp ears.
Yes, landing rights. And that little crack is going to cost you an extra 300.
Shada felt her mouth drop open. Crack? What crack? She filled her lungs for a nasty retort of her own.
We'll bid 1,000,
Card said, warning her with a glance. The controller snorted audibly.
For a freighter that size, you're either joking or a fool.
Hasishi hissed something under her breath.
Or perhaps merely a poor independent trader, Card suggested. What if I make it 1,100?
What if you make it 15? That's New Republic currency, too.
Of course. 1,500. Agreed.
Landing pad 28,
the controller said, his grudging annoyance replaced now by open gloating. Briefly, Shada wondered how much of that 1,500 would be going directly into his pocket.
Beacon'll guide you in. The money's due on arrival.
Thank you, Card said. Hab Camber out.
He keyed off the comm. Jin?
Beacon come on, Captain,
the older man at the comm station reported, squinting at his displays.
They guiding us in.
Key the vector over to the helm,
Card instructed.
Duncan, take us in. Watch out for fighters. Mara said they sometimes send escorts for unfamiliar ships.
Right,
the pilot acknowledged. Card looked at Shada.
You game for a little walk around once we're down?
Shada shrugged.
We junior crew drones are only here to serve. Where are we going?
A topcav called the Thruster Burn, Card told her. Assuming my map is correct, it's only a couple of blocks from the landing pad we've been assigned. The man I'm hoping to meet should be there.
I didn't think we needed any supplies this soon,
Shada said.
Who are we meeting, and why?
A vicious yet cultured Corellian crime lord named Krev Bombassa, Card said. He runs most of the illegal operations in this part of Cathol sector.
And we need his help?
Not particularly, Card said. But getting his permission to travel through the area would make things easier.
Ah,
Shada said, frowning at his profile. This didn't sound like the casually fearless Talon Card she'd heard so many stories about from Mazik and other smugglers.
We're worried about some things being easy, are we?
He smiled.
Always,
he said. His tone was light, but Shada could hear an odd hollowness behind it.
Captain Card?
3PO spoke up hesitantly.
Will you be needing my services on this visit?
Card smiled.
No, 3PO, thank you,
he assured the droid.
As I said, Basic is the official language down there. You can stay on the ship with the others.
The droid seemed to wilt with relief.
Thank you, sir.
Card shifted his attention back to Shada.
We'll go lightly armed, sidearm blasters only.
Understood,
Shada said.
But I'll let you carry the blaster.
worried about things getting violent?
Denkin put in.
Not at all.
Shada said coolly, getting up from her seat and heading for the bridge door.
I just prefer that my opponents not know what direction the violence is going to come from. I'll be in my cabin, Card. Let me know when you're ready.
Later, they were down. 15 minutes after that, upon payment of their landing fee and a brief negotiation regarding additional protection costs with a trio of white-uniformed Pembroke security legionnaires, Card and Shada were walking down the streets of the Erwithat spaceport. It was not, to Card's mind, what one would exactly call an inspiring place. Even at midday, a haze seemed to shroud the whole city, diffusing the sunlight and adding a dankness to the occasional breezes that stirred the hot air without any perceptible cooling effect. The ground was composed of wet sand, molecular compressed where walkways were needed, a far cry from the permacrete that was the modern construction standard. The buildings lining the walkways were made from some kind of plain but solid-looking white stone, its one-time cleanliness now marred by the brown and green mottlings of dirt and mold. A sprinkling of pedestrians roamed the streets, most showing the same general deterioration as the spaceport itself, and here and there a hurrying swoop or land speeder could be glimpsed between the buildings. It was, in short, very much the way Mara's report from 7 years ago had painted it, except probably a little shabbier.
Terrific place,
Shada commented from beside him.
I get the feeling I'm a little overdressed.
Card smiled. Dressed in a form-fitting dress, glittering with subdued blue lights, she did indeed stand out dramatically against the general drabness.
Don't worry about it, he assured her. As I said earlier, Bombassa is a cultured sort of crime lord. You can never be too overdressed for that type.
He glanced at her.
Though, personally, I have to say I prefer the silver and dark red outfit you wore when we first met at the Whistler's Whirlpool on Trogon.
I remember that outfit,
she said, her voice oddly distant.
It was the first one Mazik bought me after I became his bodyguard.
Mazik always did have good taste, Card agreed. You know, you still haven't told me why you left his service so suddenly.
You haven't told me anything about this George Cardass character we're looking for,
Shada countered.
Keep your voice down,
Card said sharply, glancing around them. There didn't seem to be anyone within earshot, but that didn't necessarily mean anything.
That's not a name you want to casually toss around here.
Even staring straight ahead, he could feel Shada's eyes on him.
He's really got you spooked, hasn't he?
She said quietly.
You weren't exactly thrilled about all this when Calrissian talked you into hunting him down. But he's really got you spooked.
You'll understand someday,
Card told her.
After I'm able to tell you the whole story.
She shrugged, her shoulder brushing briefly up against his arm with the motion.
Let's compromise,
she suggested.
Once we're off Pembroke, you can tell me half the story.
Interesting proposal, Card said. Agreed. But only if you in turn tell me half the reason why you left Mazik.
Well,
she hesitated.
Sure.
They turned a corner, and Card felt his mouth twitch. A long block away, fronting onto an open square, was the entrance to the Thruster Burn Tap Calf. Parked in front of it were perhaps 20 stripped-down speeder bikes.
On the other hand, he said quietly, getting off Pembroke may not be quite as easy as we hoped.
Looks like a swoop gang's having a meeting in there,
Shada commented.
There are the sentries, to the left, under the overhang.
I see them,
Card said. There were four of them. Large, tough-looking young men in reddish-brown jackets sitting astride their swoops. They were pretending to talk together, but it was clear that their full attention was aimed in the newcomer's direction.
It's not too late to scrub this,
Shada murmured.
We can go back to the ship, get out of here, and take our chances with whatever Bombassa decides to throw at us.
Card shook his head minutely.
We've been objects of official curiosity ever since we landed. If we try to leave now, Bombassa's people will intercept us.
In that case, our best bet is to walk right up to the place like we own it,
Shada said briskly.
Keep your hand near your blaster. That'll keep their attention on you. Not close enough that they try to draw first, though. If it comes to a fight, let me throw the first punch. And if it looks like I'm losing badly, and you get an opening, make a run for it.
Understood,
Card said, finding himself amused despite the seriousness of the situation. Shada had mostly kept to herself aboard the Wild Card, not joining into the normal shipboard camaraderie or showing any real interest in getting to know the crew. But yet here, she was slipping back into the role of bodyguard, preparing to defend Card's life even at the cost of her own. What struck him the most was the sense that down deep, she genuinely meant it. The four sentries let them get to within a few meters of the rows of parked swoops before saying anything.
Tap calf's closed,
one of them called.
That's all right,
Card said, not breaking stride, as he glanced incuriously over at them.
We're not thirsty.
The swoopers had looked like they were lounging casually on their vehicles. They weren't. Before Card and Shada had taken two more steps, they'd zoomed across the square and skidded to a halt between the newcomers and the parked swoops.
I said the place is closed,
the one who'd spoken repeated darkly. The long maneuvering vanes of his swoop pointed with unsubtle threat directly at Card's chest.
Go away.
Card shook his head.
Sorry, we have business with Krev Bombassa that can't wait.
One of the others snorted.
Listen to him, he said derisively. He thinks he can just walk in on Bombassa anytime he wants. Pretty funny, huh, Langry?
Hilarious,
the spokesman agreed, his face not showing any evidence of humor.
Last chance, Merc. Leave in one piece or in a bunch of them.
Lord Bombassa is going to be very displeased if you don't let us in,
Card warned.
Yeah?
Langry sneered, nudging a swoop forward.
Like I'm really scared.
You should be,
Card said, taking a step backward as the maneuvering vanes poked perilously close to his chest. Shada, he noted peripherally, hadn't moved backward with him, but was still standing where he'd left her, shrinking wide-eyed back from the swoop, snorting and vibrating its way alongside her, as if terrified by its presence.
Lord Bombassa doesn't like to be kept waiting.
Then I guess we ought to hurry up and put you in a box for him,
Langry said, sneering a little harder. He nudged the swoop forward another meter, forcing Card to take another rapid step backward. Not quite rapid enough, the tips of the maneuvering vanes jabbed sharply against his chest before he could get out of the way. One of the other swoopers chortled, grinning maliciously. Langry gave the swoop another burst of the throttle, clearly intent on knocking Card down this time. The movement brought him directly alongside Shada, and in that instant, she struck. It was doubtful Langry even saw it coming. One moment, Shada was standing there, transfixed, like a frightened animal in a hunter's sights. The next moment, she had swung her left leg back, rotated her upper body toward the swoop, and slammed her right fist into the side of his neck. There may have been a distinctive pop accompanying the flat crack of the blow. Card wasn't sure. What he was sure of, as Langry did a sideways cartwheel off his swoop onto the ground, was that this one was definitely out of the fight. The other three had excellent reflexes. Before Langry even hit the sand, they had twisted their handlebars around and roared off in different directions across the square, forestalling any attempt Shada might have made to similarly take them down. cutting close to the surrounding buildings, they curved around and stopped short, turning their swoops around to point towards Shada.
"Get out of the way!"
Shada snapped to Card, moving to the center of the square and dropping into a low combat stance. Turning her head back and forth, she looked at each of the swoopers in turn, as if daring them to take her on. For a few seconds, they seemed to ignore her challenge as they discussed the situation in a hand signal code Carr didn't recognize. Taking advantage of the lull, he backed up until he reached the edge of the square. So far, the swoopers hadn't shown any inclination to draw the weapons they were undoubtedly carrying, but that could change at any time. Watching them closely, he dropped his hand to his blaster.
"I don't think so," a gruff voice said in his ear.
Carefully, Card turned his head. The caution dictated by the hard muzzle suddenly pressed against the small of his back. Three hard-faced men in Security Legion uniforms were standing there, the last of them in the process of closing the concealed doorway that had opened up in the building behind him.
"You're just in time, Legionnaire," Card said to the leader.
This was probably futile, but he had to try.
"My friend's in danger out there."
"Yeah,"
the other said, pulling Card's blaster from its holster.
"Looked to me like she was the one who started it. Anyway, trying to bluster your way in to see Bombassa is a crime all by itself around here."
"Even if Bombassa decides he's glad we dropped in to visit," Card countered, "you'd be in serious trouble."
"Nah,"
the Legionnaire said, sticking the appropriated blaster into his belt and coming around to Card's side.
"That's why we got these,"
he added, hefting his weapon as he stepped a prudent meter away from his prisoner. It was, Card saw now, not a blaster, but an old Mersonne tangle gun.
"If Bombassa decides he wants to see you, hey, we just cut you loose. If he doesn't,"
he grinned evilly,
"then you're already wrapped for burial. Real convenient."
He gestured with the tangle gun.
"Now shut up. I want to watch this."
Throat tight with frustration, Card turned back to the square. The Wild Card's crew wouldn't be able to get here fast enough to help, even if he could get to his comlink to alert them. He could only hope that Shada was as good as she claimed. And at that moment, their private consultation finished, the swoopers attacked. They didn't all charge at once, as Card had rather expected them to. Suspecting perhaps that Shada would try to maneuver them into head-on collisions if they did that, two of them instead began tracing out a loose encircling ring around her, while the third drove hard and straight directly in. Shada stood her ground, but just before the maneuvering veins reached her chest, she dropped back flat onto her back. The thug whooped with glee as his swoop shot past over her, a triumphal shout that turned into a squawk of surprise as Shada tucked her legs to her chest and kicked hard straight up, catching the swoop just forward of the directional thrust nozzles and bucking the swooper right out of the saddle. It only took a second for him to get himself reseated and regain control. But in the enclosed area of the square, that was a half second too long. And with a horrendous crash, both swoop and thug slammed full bore into one of the buildings. The Legionnaire beside Card whistled softly.
"That's two,"
he commented.
"She's good."
Card didn't reply.